Johns sought to purportedly change that, pledging big reforms, holding lavish investment conferences in Riyadh, and hobnobbing with Silicon Valley executives. However, his agenda stumbled in 2018 when men working for him killed the journalist Jamal Khashoggi. That scuppered big deals including with Amazon.com, Richard Branson's space tourism venture, and Hollywood super agent Ari Emanuel. Also, the Crown Prince could not change many of the old deterrents to investment, and instead, the country added new ones. Riyadh tried to resolve the issue of a cash crunch by imposing retroactive taxes on dozens of large foreign firms. During the past year and a half, companies including Uber, its regional subsidiary, Careem, and General Electric have faced huge tax liabilities and sometimes extra fines when their appeals were rejected by Saudi courts. The U.S. State Department late last year appealed in vain to the Saudi government for relief. The kingdom further angered foreign firms when it ordered them to move their regional headquarters to Riyadh from Dubai or lose government contracts. They were also forced to employ more Saudis. Additionally, a requirement to improve local content in their products made some goods uncompetitive in comparison with imports. Furthermore, physical safety has become another concern for investors. Although the majority of the people apprehended in Prince Mohammed's crackdowns on criticism or alleged corruption have been Saudi citizens, some have been foreigners. One foreign businessman said he was detained and tortured after he had said publicly that some business laws were unfair in Saudi Arabia. Another, an American citizen, recently authorized the U.S. State Department to reveal relevant information to the media should the person be detained in Saudi Arabia. A second American citizen who sought to expand his Ohio-based nursing home operation was arrested on arrival last year. He was detained in a cramped airport holding cell for 3 days and then deported without explanation. Meanwhile, some companies which have worked in Saudi Arabia for decades have downsized their presence amid disputes over payment from government clients. Contractors on Riyadh's new subway system, including Bechtel, sent some staff home last year over a more than $1 billion payment dispute. Northrop Grumman, which has sold military equipment worth billions of dollars to Saudi Arabia, reduced its activity nearly 2 years ago after the military did not pay for products it provided. Bechtel and Northrop Grumman declined to comment. The Saudi government, meanwhile, has claimed it has reformed public procurement laws to eliminate the problem and cleared the backlog of cases. The situation is often worse for smaller companies and solo entrepreneurs, for whom minor issues can turn into painful ordeals. Suleiman Salahia, a 67-year-old, owned a small business that landscaped Saudi universities and royal palaces. After the government reversed the previous round of widely touted business reforms to favor local competitors, the Palestinian investor petitioned investment officials and then sued them. He said in court he was given less than 2 minutes to plead his case before a judge ruled against him. Barred from working or leaving the country without paying hundreds of thousands of dollars in disputed fees, Suleiman Salahia remains mired in red tape and stranded in Riyadh with his wife and children, who haven't been able to complete their education or start their own careers. After Salahia, already facing the consequences of the court ruling, spoke with a Wall Street Journal reporter in 2018, Saudi police raided his home in the middle of the night, bound his hands and feet, and covered his head with a bag. They stuffed him into an SUV and drove him to a small cell, where he remained for 18 days with the air conditioning running full blast and two spotlights keeping him awake. Interrogators asked about his business dealings, the lawsuits, and his meeting with a foreign journalist.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Deen al-Islam, deen al-Azam, ghayru deen Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Before we deal with the law of miscellaneous nature, which is the topic today, and inshallah in the upcoming episodes, let's take a listen to a short biography of Ayatollah Sistani.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzumah Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazwini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in Fiqh and Usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Halli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Halli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Back to the program Islamic Law on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. And our dear guest speaker, as always in the studio, sitting with me, Sheikh Javid. Salam alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the studio again.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me on this program.
Welcome. Let's talk about some of the questions that require basically general and miscellaneous answers. Let me start with the concept of kosher. We all know that Muslims all across the globe need to eat a special kind of food which is sacrificed or killed in the way which has been, in fact, prescribed by Sharia laws, right?
Yeah.
And we also know that, you know, not everywhere can you find Muslims, right? There are some places which are very remote from other Muslim-dominated areas. So basically, we are, you know, sometimes finding a scarcity of foods, you know, based on the Sharia laws, right? Islamically speaking. So can Muslims suffice with kosher in this regard?
Well, there are some Muslims out there thinking that kosher must be halal because it comes from an animal that is slaughtered very much like in the way that Muslims slaughter the animals.
Mm-hmm.
So kosher is actually the meat of an animal, a halal animal,
mm-hmm.
That is slaughtered by a Jew. Okay.
Yes.
And reportedly, the Jews, in fact, slaughter the animals in the same way as we do. But
do they face it to Qibla?
No, that is not. That's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other problems as well, you know.
Right.
There are some Sunni sects or denominations saying that kosher is halal, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so they eat. But the Shia religious authorities say that kosher is absolutely forbidden.
Unanimously.
Unanimously, of course, because it lacks certain requirements
mm-hmm.
that must be fulfilled while slaughtering an animal.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most important requirements is the fact that the person who slaughters the animal is not a Muslim, okay? He is a Jew.
Mm-hmm.
He does not believe in the Prophet of Islam, and obviously he does not. And then the other condition that is also missing is that he does not recite takbir.
Mm-hmm.
And there is also a third condition which is not fulfilled, and that is that the animal is not slaughtered in the direction of Qibla. So these three main conditions are missing, and obviously kosher cannot be halal. Now there are some Muslims, some Muslims, and even some Shia Muslims who are living in a Sunni setting, saying that we can, for example, make the meat halal by just reciting takbir. Okay, the meat is there in the supermarket; it's on sale, and of course you can buy
it. Obviously, it's a dead. Yeah. Animals,
and
meat, right?
Yeah, it is a dead, and it comes from a dead animal. The animal has already been slaughtered by either mechanically
mm-hmm.
or maybe by hand, manually.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
but some people are there who maintain that if you recite, let's say Bismillah or Takbir or anything or utter God's name,
yes,
then the meat becomes halal.
Right.
And the number of those people who believe as such is not, unfortunately, few and far between. There are many, many Muslims who believe that, such meat sold on the market can be made halal by reciting Bismillah. But that's not correct. This
right.
is this idea may come from some Sunni minority group, okay? But we, the Shia Muslims, do not believe in such thing. Okay, the meat must be halal, and in order for a Muslim to consume halal meat, he should make sure that first of all the meat, the animal is slaughtered by a Muslim, and then all the
requirements should be met.
The requirements should be met. There are certain requirements, of course, which have been explained in the manual of Islamic laws, and all right. these requirements are essential and mm-hmm. they must be fulfilled, otherwise the meat is not halal.
Okay, let's take a break and we'll discuss and continue this topic after the break. Stay with us.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
Back to the program, Islamic Law on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, and my guest is still Sheikh Javed in the studio. Sheikh Javed, you were talking about kosher and the status of, yeah. or jurisprudential status of kosher. Would you like to add anything?
Yeah. If you go to the West, to non-Muslim countries, of course, there are big stores, selling meat, and there is a tag on the meat, mm-hmm. halal tag, okay?
Yes.
And this halal tag is everywhere. Halal meat mm-hmm. is very expensive.
Yes.
It's not found everywhere, just as rightly mentioned, because of the paucity and the scarcity of halal meat. Halal meat is expensive. It's not available everywhere.
Everywhere, yeah.
So that's why some people add or write the tag, the halal tag, to the meat, so that they can sell the meat for higher prices.
Mm-hmm.
And so now many people think, okay, this meat must be halal because there's a tag, halal tag, on the meat, and so
yes.
it can be consumed.
Right.
But is it really valid? The tag, does it suggest that the meat is really halal? No one knows. Especially if the seller is non-Muslim,
mm-hmm.
okay, he sells the meat either in a restaurant or in a store, okay.
So what should a Muslim do?
Yeah.
Should a Muslim actually go about research?
So the religious authority says that the tag should not be taken for it should not be relied upon, because anybody can make use of the tag, halal tag, and sell his meat, okay. The thing that a Muslim should do is that the first of all, he should make sure that the person who sells the meat is a Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this
if
is very
not,
important. And if he is not a Muslim, then according to the a widely accepted principle of jurisprudence, that meat is automatically treated as non-halal, even if that meat is, the meat is said to be halal, but
yes.
since the seller is a non-Muslim, you cannot trust that person. You cannot trust that person, and you cannot buy it. So the meat, basically, according to the principle of jurisprudence, is treated as non-halal,
mm-hmm.
unless there are indications or there are signs indicating that the meat is halal. For example, if that person is a Muslim,
mm-hmm.
and that Muslim is not a carefree person, someone who's reckless, who's not very much, who's not a practicing Muslim. So,
yes.
And there's a big difference between a practicing Muslim and non-practicing Muslim. If a Muslim is a practicing Muslim, he offers prayers, he actually gives his zakat and does.
Sheikh Javed, when I go to a supermarket, I can't really do a research about how practicing, or whether the salesperson is a practicing Muslim or not. Isn't it too difficult and demanding
for you? Okay, for you this criterion does not apply.
Mm-hmm.
This standard does not apply. So you as a guest, as someone who who goes to who is new to a country,
yes,
cannot eat and consume meat. You should be careful. You should exercise precaution,
mm-hmm,
and therefore, unless the person is a reliable Muslim and he is, the face of that individual, mm-hmm, who is a Muslim, clearly suggests that, yes, he is a kind of practicing Muslim, yeah, and a reliable person, then you can buy the meat and consume it. Otherwise, you cannot eat that meat.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, contributing to the program Islamic Law on Arabi English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, signing off.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, is in hot water, facing a growing leadership challenge. Johnson had already run the gauntlet of public anger for his handling of a sleaze scandal, the awarding of lucrative COVID contracts, and the refurbishment of his Downing Street flat. Now, Johnson is under growing pressure from members of Parliament, some of whom Tory lawmakers, after revelations that he attended a garden party at his Downing Street residence in May 2020 in breach of his government's coronavirus lockdown rules. The scandal even worsened after it was disclosed that a party was also held in Downing Street the night before the funeral of Prince Philip last April, when mixing indoors was banned. The stories about rule-breaking get-togethers had caused deep anger, and to thousands who had lost relatives or friends to COVID-19, intense anguish and pain. The mix was potentially politically lethal for the entire Conservative Party. Johnson himself has shifted from the party's biggest asset, with a Brexit-fueled appeal separate to the Conservative brand, to its biggest liability. Not only had Johnson lost his respect, but also sticking with him risks further contaminating the party brand if the scandals continue. The UK government has launched an internal inquiry into revelations about multiple gatherings by Johnson's staff during COVID lockdowns. Johnson himself has apologized for attending what he called only a work meeting at a time when social mixing was banned. Meanwhile, the opposition, Labour, has seized the opportunity, saying Johnson broke the law, lied, and must resign. The opposition Labour Party, which has surged in the polls since the Partygate revelations began emerging last month, says Johnson is unfit for office. Sir Keir Starmer said the Prime Minister's actions and his inability to take any responsibility for them means he can no longer do his basic duties. A new poll released on Sunday showed that the Labour Party has opened up its biggest lead against the Tories since 2013 amid criticism leveled at Boris Johnson and his party over social gatherings during COVID-19 lockdowns. The poll conducted by Opinium says Johnson's personal approvals fall below the worst figures ever recorded by Theresa May. Just 22% of people approve of the job Johnson is doing as Prime Minister. Also, his party sinks to its worst vote shares since the general election, 10 points behind Labour. Also, around two-thirds of people surveyed believe Johnson and his colleagues have broken the rules and lied about it, and say Johnson should resign. That's why Boris Johnson secured a landslide election victory in 2019. But according to the poll, nearly half of Conservative voters at the 2019 election now say he should step down. The Sunday Times reported that Johnson will look to get on the front foot and save his position by making a series of populist announcements in the coming weeks, including reducing the national health system backlog, tackling the small boat crossings in the Channel, freezing the BBC license fee for 2 years, and introducing a booze ban in Downing Street. But is that enough? The latest poll shows voters across the political spectrum are angry with the revelations, and most of those who supported the Conservatives in the 2019 election are turning against them. Add to it a looming cost of living crisis, inadequate public services, a pandemic to recover from, and ongoing difficulties caused by Brexit. It's now just a question of how long will Boris Johnson survive as the Prime Minister. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi hosted his Iranian counterpart Hossein Amir Abdollahian in the city of Wuxi in Jiangsu province on Friday. The Chinese and Iranian foreign ministers announced the launch of a 25-year cooperation agreement aimed at strengthening economic and political ties. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian says the strategic cooperation agreement between Tehran and Beijing is built on a win-win approach in line with the interests of both countries. The Iranian diplomat outlined the latest state of bilateral cooperation in various fields and said Tehran is resolved to implement all infrastructure agreements with Beijing. Iran and China signed the landmark Sino-Iranian Comprehensive Strategic Partnership Agreement in March last year in defiance of the U.S. unilateral sanctions to strengthen the long-standing economic and political alliance. It paves the way for Iran's participation in the Belt and Road Initiative, a massive infrastructure project stretching from East Asia to Europe. Meanwhile, Beijing once again voiced its firm opposition to unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States against Iran. The Chinese foreign minister said the U.S. bears primary responsibility for the ongoing difficulties with Iran, having unilaterally withdrawn from a 2015 nuclear deal. The United States reimposed the sanctions that the agreement had removed and slapped new bans under different labels. Wang said China firmly opposes unilateral sanctions against Iran, political manipulation through topics including human rights, and interference in the internal affairs of Iran and other regional countries. He also noted that Beijing completely supports Iran's wise stand toward the bullying policies of the United States, and also its position on the ongoing talks with the five remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear agreement, urging Washington to make up for the past mistake in withdrawing from the deal.
That this 25-year agreement with China represents new possibilities for Iran to really, if not break out of the sanctions, at least they have a lifeline for the things that they will need thanks to this long-term agreement with China. And for China, of course, it's a major undertaking because it is long-term. They do expect it to last over two decades. So this is something that is a permanent feature of the political architecture. And I think it represents a tremendous opening for Iran to retake its own rightful place in the array of nations of the world, in the Middle East and globally.
Since Washington's 2018 withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal, followed by subsequent sanctions aimed at crushing the Iranian economy, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has underlined the necessity of pressing ahead with efforts to neutralize the sanctions. Under that strategy, Iran has tried to adopt an east-oriented economic policy, expanding its ties with neighboring and other Asian countries and striving to become self-sufficient in key domains. China is Iran's number one trade partner. This partnership heavily relies on Iran's oil supply to energy-hungry China. Reports show that in 2021, and despite U.S. oil embargoes on Iran, China tripled its oil imports from the country. Now the implementation of the new pact will guarantee the flow of Iran's oil to China and cement the two sides' trade ties. Also, a review of trade between Iran and Russia shows Tehran's exports to Moscow increased by 58%, including 62% in agricultural and food products in the first 9 months of the current Persian year, which ends on March 20th. Tehran says a long-term cooperation roadmap between Iran and Russia is at its final stage of development as the Islamic Republic takes the initiative to expand its ties with neighboring, regional, and friendly countries to neutralize sanctions.
China and Russia are fighting back. They're going to be playing a major role. They're going to maintain their relations with the countries that they have a good relationship with and Iran is one of these. And they're not going to be bullied by the independent or unilateral sanctions or even any other sanctions that would be placed on a country like Iran.
Tehran has also pursued the removal of sanctions through diplomatic channels, including the negotiations in Austria's capital, Vienna.
The eighth round of talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA goes on in Vienna to revive the deal.
Tehran says all anti-Iran sanctions should be removed in a verifiable manner. Tehran also says the U.S. should give guarantees that it won't leave the deal again.
Tensions between Russia and the West are spiraling out of control. The West is accusing Moscow of planning to invade its western neighbor, Ukraine, citing increased Russian military activities along the border. Russia rejects the allegation and says its military buildup is to ensure security in the face of NATO's eastward expansion. Back in December, Russia proposed two draft treaties to Washington and NATO that demanded assurances that western troops won't be deployed near Russian borders. Last week, U.S. and Russian officials held talks over the tensions. Soviet representatives from NATO and Moscow to de-escalate the situation. The talks ended without any significant breakthrough. Russia now says it has run out of patience with the West as tensions escalate over Ukraine. Moscow expects the U.S. and NATO to provide by next week a detailed written response to its security demands.
We're waiting for the written reaction. We have reasons to believe that our partners have understood the necessity to react quickly, precisely, and on paper. And they have understood that we're not going to wait forever. But of course, there are plans to drag it on and on.
Sergei Lavrov says
Moscow needs legally binding guarantees, and meeting these demands would be essential for finding a diplomatic solution. According to Lavrov, his country has various options if the West rejects its security proposals.
I think the most likely thing is that they would announce that they're putting ships off the American coast with hypersonic weapons on them that could reach American cities within 5 or 7 minutes, similar to the threat they say they're facing in Eastern Europe. I think there are things they could do in Ukraine, for example, hitting the Azov battalion or some of the bases the Ukrainians have put on the Sea of Azov. They could deploy weapons to Kaliningrad Oblast. They could be announcing the targeting of European capitals. I think there are many things they can do to increase the pain level in Europe.
Russia has long warned against Ukraine's possible membership in NATO, describing it as its red line. Russia is raising the stakes by suggesting that it might deploy military hardware to Venezuela and Cuba if the escalation talks fail. Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov, who led Russia's delegation in a meeting with the U.S. on Monday, says the move depends on the actions of the Americans. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan dismissed the warning as bluster, adding that the paths forward are either diplomacy or confrontation.
I think there's a chance of a compromise, but I think the chances are extremely small. I know some observers have taken some indications that maybe privately the Americans are willing to be more willing to make concessions to Moscow security demands, but I don't think that's going to happen. I think the Russians feel they were giving one last chance for the Western countries, particularly the United States, to see reason and give them security guarantees. I don't think that's going to happen.
Moscow and the West have had strained relations since the 2014 repatriation of Crimea from Ukraine to Russia, following a referendum in which more than 90% voted in favor of the move. The West, nonetheless, described it as illegal. The European Union and some other Western countries joined Washington in introducing several rounds of sanctions against Russia. The tense relations between the U.S. and Russia took a turn for the worse after Washington withdrew from Cold War-era IMF and Open Skies treaties. The recent tensions are definitely a cause for concern for people around the world, because if a second Cold War gets out of control, it could prove costlier than the first for all sides.
Arab intellectuals and ordinary people are still angry over UAE's normalization of ties with Israel. A number of intellectuals from Persian Gulf Arab states have announced that they will boycott a literature festival that is set to take place in Abu Dhabi in February. Omani writer Bushra Khalfan and Kuwaiti writers Mona Al-Shamri, Ahmed Al-Zamam and Ali Ashur decided to boycott the Emirates Airlines Festival of Literature.
Yeah, I guess this development indeed shows that there is a large number of people who disapprove. And that has been the case all along, because we need to keep in mind that these regimes are not elected by their population, and they don't necessarily make decisions on behalf of the population in these countries.
The intellectuals have cited UAE's normalization of ties with Israel for the decision to boycott the event. The list of invitees included writers, academics, and intellectuals from a number of Arab countries. Other writers from Persian Gulf countries have also been called to withdraw from the event. The festival will take place from February the 3rd to 13th at its new venue for 2022. UAE's image has been tarnished amongst Arab intellectuals and ordinary people for its decision to normalize ties. Palestinians have described the move as a stab in the back of the Palestinian cause.
And of course, the public communication and freedom of speech is very strongly restricted in the UAE, which means that public dissent and in this case, and of course, public expressions against the normalization with the Israeli regime, of course, can lead to consequences for the populations.
The United States United Arab Emirates is amongst a group of Arab states that have normalized ties with the Israeli regime as part of a controversial initiative brokered by the United States in 2020. The Emiratis opened their embassy in Israel in July 2021. Israel has also opened an embassy in the Emirates capital, Abu Dhabi, and the consulate in the UAE business hub, Dubai. Over the past year, the two sides have signed many deals ranging from financial services to tourism. And in December, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett visited the UAE to further deepen the ties between the two regimes. The UAE was not the only country to normalize its ties with Israel. Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco have also established diplomatic relations with the Tel Aviv regime. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has already vowed to help Israel normalize relations with additional countries in the Muslim and Arab worlds. Blinken said the Biden administration would continue to build on the successful efforts of the last administration to keep normalization marching forward.
Well, the Israeli colony is in many ways a proxy and a military base for the United States, and it helps secure the U.S. role in Western Asia and beyond. So, of course, the Israeli regime is of essential importance for the United States, and expanding Israel's ties to the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, and then potentially other governments and regimes in the region is, of course, of central interest because Israel is central for the military-industrial complex.
Palestinians are outraged by the normalization, which they believe is threatening their planned statehood. The stance adopted by these Arab governments seem to be helping the Israeli regime to move out of deep isolation in the West Asia region. Palestinians say those Arab states are stabbing them in the back.
Now, that, as a result, of course, the Palestinian struggle has not been of any importance, or has even rather become an obstacle for many of these regimes. But at the same time, of course, it does not reflect necessarily the popular mood in these places, where many people are, of course, pro-Palestinian and do support the liberation of Palestine.
Palestinians have been fighting an uphill battle against the Israeli occupation for decades. Things are perhaps tougher today, as several Arab states are undermining the Palestinian cause by moving closer to Israel.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
Turtles get a second chance to spread their fins after being found with bellies full of plastic. They were rescued and are now being released back to the sea in Argentina. Two green turtles and four loggerhead turtles were saved from fishing nets in Buenos Aires province. The group was taken to Grupo Marina Foundation, where they recuperated after purging 10 types of plastic from their bodies. Rehabilitation of the turtles lasted over a month and included blood tests and other procedures to make sure they were free of plastic. A biologist with a foundation says the danger of plastic is that it's silent, and usually its dangers are so gradual that it goes unnoticed.
Many times the animal appears to be in perfect health. However, during the checkup and evaluation, we found a large amount of this material inside. So it is important to get rid of the plastic before the condition worsens and it ends up causing the deaths of the specimens.
The turtles had mistakenly eaten plastic, thinking it was food. Wind, waves, and sunshine break down discarded plastic into tiny pieces, which litter ocean waters. Much of this plastic waste can be found on beds of seaweed that turtles forage for food. This trash ends up fatally clogging their bellies, causing the decline in the population of these graceful reptiles. The Indian Indian-administered Kashmir has the world's only floating post office, a 200-year-old houseboat on a famous Dal Lake in Srinagar. Set up during the British rule in India, the post office has survived throughout the years because of its charm. Our correspondent Shahana Bhatt has more.
The Indian-administered Kashmir was once a princely independent state, out of bounds for outsiders. As the ruler of Jammu and Kashmir disallowed non-locals to own property in this picturesque region. During the British rule in the Indian subcontinent, many Britons tried to find an alternative way of living in Kashmir. Thus, houseboat on the world-famous Dal Lake came into existence. Today, the lake is a home to hundreds of such boats, which are a major attraction for tourists around the globe. This one is a unique boat, the only floating post office in the whole world. This is a 200-year-old boat built by the British. It has truly stood the test of time, as it still functions.
Post office, Dal Lake.
This is not an ordinary post office. We're standing on a heritage property. I've enjoyed my work since the very first day I came here. It's a unique experience to be working here, and every day I get the chance to meet people from different corners of the world.
The boat is not limited to postal services. It also has a small museum where colorful stamps from the 1980s are put to display, along with a collection of rare philately stamps. The post office is a hot tourist destination in the region. Locals also come to this post office to send postcards to their loved ones, inviting them to visit Kashmir.
Floating post office.
In the age of technology, electronic mails, e-cards and other internet applications have made it extremely easy for people to communicate. But sending a postcard from this floating post office gives one a really different feeling.
The floating post office underwent reconstruction in 2011 and is currently a part of the Indian postal system. Recently, the office started offering banking services, thus attracting more locals.
I have opened an account here for my daughter. It's hassle-free and this place suits my mind. It's not like the usual offices. Visiting this place with kids is like a trip.
Yet another attraction of this post office is this souvenir shop, from where everyone can buy postcards, stamps, traditional crafts and greeting cards.
This floating post office in Kashmir's Dal Lake is like a time machine. It brings people back to 2 centuries ago and shows them the history of the beautiful region. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Now let's go to Germany to hear the heartwarming story of how technology is turning a young boy's life around. 7-year-old Joshua has a severe lung disease which has made him unable to go to school. But now he can attend his classes from home with the help of an avatar robot. The device sits in Joshua's Berlin classroom, enabling him to listen to the classroom in real time to what his teacher and classmates are saying. Joshua can even interact with everyone else by making the robot display a blinking signal.
Each year, a village in Vietnam becomes awash in red and orange as it gears up for the Lunar New Year with spectacular mass production of incense. January is usually the busiest time when villagers are dyeing, drying and whittling bamboo bark to make the fragrance sticks. Also, the scent of each batch is carefully tailored to suit the tastes of the regions where they will be sold. Most households here are involved in this ancient trade and sales are a major part of their livelihoods. The Lunar New Year will begin on the first day of February. Around this time, sales tick up with throngs of people crowding into temples to light incense during worship. A 3-year-old girl from China's Hebei province has astonished ski enthusiasts with her impressive snowboarding talent.
Hello, everybody. I'm Wang Shishi. I'm 3 years old and I can snowboard now.
Shishi's skills have attracted a lot of attention as a toddler boldly tackles the slopes. She makes snowboarding look easy. Despite her tender age, she is already taming the slopes at a higher skill level than a number of other aspiring snowboarders. Her parents say she has been practicing for less than 2 weeks and her progress is startling.
I remember several years ago, I felt quite scared when I was on the advanced slope, but her mother told me that Shishi started to snowboard down right when she got to the advanced trail. She was not afraid at all.
Her parents say she quickly grasped the snowboarding movements and techniques, including some of the trickier swivels and turns. They say Shishi is enjoying the progress she is making on the slopes, and every chance she gets, she asks to go snowboarding. The young snowboarder's mum says the hobby has also brought the family closer together as they enjoy a shared passion together.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
The chronic shortage of human organs has always been an issue for patients, especially those suffering from heart diseases. But now a major scientific breakthrough is in the making. U.S. surgeons have successfully implanted a heart from a genetically modified pig into a man. Doctors had said the patient, 57-year-old, was unable to have human transplant because of his health conditions. But now he is recovering from his latest surgery. The surgeons say the man is being carefully monitored to determine how the new organ is performing. But for those who want to know why pigs, here is why. Pigs are considered ideal donors because of their size and rapid growth, among other things.
You know, it is a game changer because, we will have these organs readily available. If this works, and I hope it will work, we'll have these organs available. We have the technique of genetically modifying. So if there are more tweaking required for modifying the genes, we will be able to do that, and can customize basically the heart for or the organ for the patient.
The transplant is the first of its kind in the world and follows years of research. In the U.S. alone, about 110,000 people are currently waiting for an organ transplant. Also, more than 6,000 patients die each year before getting one. A Kingdom of Ice and Snow. Don't be surprised. It's an international sculpture festival held annually in the Chinese city of Harbin. This year, the venue brims with sports elements in a runner-up to the 2022 Winter Olympics scheduled in Beijing. The annual Winter Festival is the largest of its kind, where sculptors spend weeks using ice and snow to create structures under a given theme. The upcoming Winter Games is the theme this year, as one can visualize giant statues of Bing Duan Duan. The adorable panda mascots are major attractions of the exhibition. The chief designer says an ice tower standing in the center of the park features 24 vertical structures, referring to the 24th Winter Olympics.
In terms of the design concept, the sculpture features 24 vertical structures, referring to the 24th Winter Olympics to be held in Beijing. The spiral array form also indicated the proactive spirit of the Olympics. The free and upward effect is a vivid presentation of the Olympic flame.
The annual festival, which is being held for about 3 decades, usually attracts domestic and foreign tourists. But COVID-19 restrictions have limited the crowds over the past couple of years. Harbin is located in northeast China and receives cold winter wind from Siberia. An average winter temperature there is around minus 17 degrees Celsius.
South Koreans enjoy a wildlife refuge near the Korean Demilitarized Zone. New tours opened in November from the DMZ Crane Peace Town. Frank Smith has more in this report.
A new hiking trail and birdwatching facility opened up in South Korea this past November. DMZ Crane Peace Town created special birding cabins and guides wilderness hikes north of the 38th parallel, near the DMZ, the fortified border with North Korea. The Demilitarized Zone was created with the armistice that ended the Korean War back in 1953. Guard post fencing and a 2 to 4 kilometer wide buffer zone now separate North Korea and South Korea, with that no man's land becoming home to rejuvenated plant and wildlife. Local officials see wildlife tourism as an opportunity to promote inter-Korean peace.
Cranes know no borders. That's why we're promoting the crane as a symbol of peace, as they can freely come and go between North and South Korea.
Each winter, several species of birds, especially cranes, spend time to rest and feed in the area, where there's little development and few people. Officials say more birds have been coming here because of depleted feeding grounds in the north.
Shirwan has wide plains suitable for growing rice. Cranes eat the grain that has fallen after harvest, and it's the best place for cranes because it's located north of the civilian control line.
A safe vantage point to photograph the wildlife is provided at the Hantan River near Yangji Village, attracting birders from far afield.
I left home at 4 in the morning to come here to photograph wild birds, swans and cranes. It's good because there are many mallard ducks and other birds. They fight for food with each other, but it's fun.
Cranes are considered a sacred symbol of longevity and fortune here and designated a national monument. Frank Smith, Cheongwon County, South Korea.
In Germany, tasty bits of crumbs are all it takes for hundreds of sheep and goats to participate in the campaign to encourage vaccination against COVID-19. 700 farm animals were arranged into a 100-meter-long syringe in a pasture south of Hamburg. The shepherd says she spent several days practicing the herd. The sheep and goats were lured by pieces of bread, which they quickly gobbled up after being released into the field. Helping the shepherd was an organizer who works with a flock to run team training exercises for companies. He says they wanted to do something to grab people's attention and encourage them to get COVID jabs.
Well, if I were to just write it on Facebook, nobody would notice it. And my job is to have company teams leading some thousand sheep from A to B, and I have noticed how enthusiastically the sheep are received, and that it simply reaches people deep inside, which is perhaps not possible rationally, with rational arguments.
Etzold says sheep bring out the soft side of people and hopes that this will help convey the message. So far, the campaign has received a positive response, with videos of the sheep arrangement going viral. Official data shows Germany has the lowest inoculation rate among Western European nations. This is mainly attributed to vaccination hesitancy, as well as a small percentage who vehemently oppose getting the jab.
IRIB English Radio.